Hello and welcome to a special edition of Midday in partnership with WYPR News. I'm John Lee. I'm joined by WYPR reporter Wamboy Kamau, and we're getting ready for a live Baltimore City mayoral debate at 12:30. The event is being sponsored by WYPR in addition to WJZ, the Baltimore Banner, and the Schaefer Center for Public Policy at University of Baltimore. Moderators for the debate include our midday host, Tom Hall. That's why you're hearing me and not him right now. And WJZ anchor Denise Koch and Baltimore Banner City Hall reporter Emily Sullivan.
Good afternoon. Today's debate will include four candidates: current mayor and incumbent Brandon Scott, former Mayor Sheila Dixon, former city prosecutor Thiru Vignaraja, and businessman Bob Wallace. We have my friend, WYPR reporter Emily Hofstetter, at site at the debate. Hi, Emily. Can you let us know what's happening there? Who do you see, and what do you expect listeners to hear during this debate?
Hey, good afternoon, John and Wamboy. So as far as who I see, you know, we still are about half an hour outside of the start, so people are still getting settled, and it's a fairly small crowd. It's the middle of the day. We're at a university. We do have a handful of students, and as well as a handful of invited members of the public from all sorts of walks of life. I've had a really good time just chatting to them for the past half hour or so, talking about the issues that really matter to them. You know, we're going to be hearing about a lot of those issues. We did take some listener questions beforehand, so we can get into some of the things, you know, we can expect to hope to hear from candidates. But I can say that the people gathered here, you know, ranging from college age to, you know, elderly grandparents, a few things really stick out. The two that everyone has actually mentioned are affordable housing and education. Now, education might make sense. You know, we are in a university at this time, but affordable housing seems to be really a hot button issue right now. And I know that is a question that our moderators will likely be asking our candidates about, and education, of course. We have heard some people talk about crime, of course, as a big issue for them. This particular crowd, though, seems to feel that crime is a problem, but they are optimistic about the direction that the city is going with it, and they want to hear more from our candidates about how they are going to continue to drive down the homicide rate. As it was very widely reported back in 2023, we did have a 20% drop in homicide. Of course, our incumbent mayor, Brandon Scott, is going to be taking a lot of credit for that, and I can imagine his opponents will push back on him for some of that. So a little bit of what's going on right now.
Thanks, Emily. Before you go, I have a question or two for you. The issue of education is always interesting in the city because there have certainly been previous mayors who, because the city doesn't provide very much of the funding compared to other localities, that it's almost like a hands-off when it comes to the schools. But do you expect that to be a different story today during this debate?
Yeah, you know, as you mentioned, education is kind of a wonky one. And in all fairness, I think that's something that it's a little bit new for everyone. The state passed the blueprint for Maryland's future, which requires the cities to chip in a lot more money. So last year, Baltimore City contributed a historic amount of education funding. So that has had to, that's had effects in other parts of the city budget. And, you know, we can see that in upcoming years, they'll be contributing more to education. And pretty notably, we've had a CEO of City Schools that seems to have a fairly congenial relationship with our mayor. Turnover is typically high for that role, and Santelices has been in it for a while. And so that has seemed to create more of a conversation about how the mayor and the CEO of schools can be working together. But on that note, John, you know, education, it's not just the city schools. That often includes like things like youth programming that the city does have more say in. So that could be through the Parks and Recs Department, through job training, through other youth-oriented activities. I expect all of our four candidates today to talk about education in some type of more holistic role than just thinking about the city school system.
And when it comes to affordable housing that you mentioned a couple of minutes ago, has there been a candidate in particular that you that among the four that has really taken a lead in making that a major issue for their campaign?
Well, Well, I mean, it's certainly something that Mayor Scott talks a whole lot about. It's something that comes up, you know, amongst all of the candidates when we talk about the vacant housing crisis. You know, can some of these vacants be turned into affordable housing is the question that I think everybody in the city has. But, you know, recently the city council did pass an affordable housing law. So I imagine the mayor is going to talk about his support for that. That affordable housing law that is that requires a percentage, I believe it's 15% of all units in new construction to be set aside for affordable housing. That's families making 50% or below AMI, average median income. And most notably, one of those places, if it is constructed, that will include that affordable housing will be the new development at the Inner Harbor, Harbor Place.
And Emily, going back, continuing on that line of affordable housing, you said that the people you're speaking to are really concerned about this. So can you tell us a little bit more? Is this because it's students and, you know, they're looking at whether they can afford to live off campus? Or is it more of those elderly people that you were saying because they have, you know, maybe restricted incomes are really worried about that?
So I would say it's both. And one of the things that's interesting and unique about a lot of the students that I've been speaking to here, University of Baltimore is very much a commuter campus. So a lot of those students are already dealing with housing issues themselves. Either they're living with family and would like to move out, or they're living in the city with roommates and already contending with life as a renter or a homeowner in Baltimore City. So it's very much an intergenerational concern. Old people on, or elderly people on a fixed income are concerned about how that income is going to stretch. And for some of those younger people, the question is, are they going to be able to afford rent? Are they going to be able to become homeowners someday?
Can you tell in the audience who has the most support there among the candidates? Is there a particular bunch of supporters that you're seeing for a particular candidate?
You know, at this time, I can't say that specifically. I don't see anyone in big signs, you know, supporting the candidate in one way or another, which, you know, does happen sometimes. I've definitely seen people blinged out in shirts and all of that. But I'm not seeing much of that right now. And, you know, I have to say people, we've still got a little bit of time. They're out and about milling, talking to each other. So it might just be that from my vantage point, I can't see everyone yet.
Okay, very good. Thank you. That's WYPR reporter Emily Hofstetter. Thanks, Emily.
Thanks, John.
All right, let's take a few moments to explore some of the candidates in the mayor's race, and let's start with the incumbent mayor, Brandon Scott. Wamboy, give us a little background on Mayor Scott and what should voters pay attention to in his responses today.
Mayor Scott was elected in 2020 in the middle of the pandemic and ran against Sheila Dixon. In that primary, he won with 29.6% of the vote, while Sheila Dixon had 27.5%. A primary focus of his first term and his reelection campaign has been addressing gun violence and homicides. He continues to tout success on reducing homicides and held a press conference last week on this issue. This is what he shared.
Homicides and non-fatal shootings were down 20% and 8% respectively in 2023. And as of today, we are building on top of that historic reduction in Baltimore City, dropping homicides by another 32.9%. And a 20.4% in non-fatal shootings. Now, we acknowledge that it's progress, but know that we have a long way to go. And together is how we're going to get there.
Wamboy, how do you think voters overall are responding to his reduction on homicides and attention to gun violence?
There are voters who appreciate his holistic approach to public safety. You know, in comparison, previous administrations, historically, their approach was broken windows policing. And that's the idea that focusing on low-level offenses prevents or reduces crime. And that resulted in mass arrests, especially of African Americans. Now, Mayor Brandon Scott has implemented the Group Violence Reduction Strategy, or GVRS. It identifies people who are most likely to be victims or perpetrators of violence and offers them services. There are also other voters who say that if GVRS is working, pointing to the reductions that he's talked about, you know, let's widen that scope and let's add crimes like carjacking. They don't want it to be just limited to gun violence and reducing homicides.
Another candidate in the race is former city prosecutor Tharu Vignaraja. Most recently, he ran for city state's attorney 2022, lost to Ivan Bates in 2020. Vignaraja ran for mayor, came in fourth. For this campaign, he's been very vocal about the development in the city, and specifically, we're referring to Harbor Place. Let's hear what he said about this on Midday's Conversations with the Candidates interview last month.
What they are proposing at Harbor Place is just terrible. I've been very vocal in my opposition. I'm the only candidate.
Because of the apartment building and blocking the views?
The notion that we're going to take dedicated public space and construct two luxury apartments, 32 floors, 25 floors, on the promenade that is ours is, and I put it in a tweet, I said it was a colossal sinful mistake. And somebody responded and said, oh my God, I had no idea Tharu is such a, so dramatic, a drama queen, I think. And I said, no, this is what James Rouse's son, Ted Rouse, said was the most precious waterfront property in America. It is ours, and the notion that we're gonna give it away to developers for to make their economics, you know, more profitable, I think it's shameful.
He made his stance on Harbor Place pretty clear there. Wamboy, do you think his position is seen as advocacy for city residents or hindering the city's development?
Yeah, John. So like so many things in the city, it all depends on who you ask. There are citizens groups like the Inner Harbor Coalition who say that Vignaraja is advocating because they're opposed to the idea of having those two towering apartment buildings on a public land, especially if it's going to take public financing. And then there are others who say that he's hindering the city's development because Harbor Place was in receivership until developer David Bramble and Peter Pinkard of MCB Real Estate stepped in. Now, voters will have a chance to decide on the future of Harbor Place because it will be a referendum on the ballot in November.
If you're just joining us, I'm John Lee, joined in the studio by WIPR reporter Wamboy Kamau. We're getting ready for a mayoral debate live from the University of Baltimore starting at 12:30. We'll hear from the four top candidates in the race, Mayor Brandon Scott, former Mayor Sheila Dixon, former city prosecutor Tharu Vignaraja, and businessman Bob Wallace. University of Baltimore's Schaefer Center for Public Policy is a partner in this debate. Midday host Tom Hall spoke with Dr. Roger Hartley, the dean of the College of Public Affairs, which houses the Schaefer Center, about today's debate. Let's give it a listen.
Dr. Roger Hartley is the dean of the College of Public Affairs at the University of Baltimore. That college includes the Schaefer Center for Public Policy at the University of Baltimore. They are partnering with us and with WJZ-TV and the Baltimore Banner to present today's debate. Roger, good to have you back.
Gosh, it's great to be here, Tom, and thanks for having me on your show. Really appreciate it.
Well, you know, debates are part and parcel of virtually every kind of campaign, from the local level to the federal level. We're 2 days away from early voting starting. A number of people have already mailed in ballots. How important do you think these kinds of forums and debates are, particularly at this, you know, late stage of the campaign?
Well, you know, it always depends on the race, but I think in this race, this debate is really, really important, especially with the top two candidates, incumbent Mayor Brandon Scott and Sheila Dixon, being in kind of the same place they were 4 years ago. It's a tight race. You know, there's some polls that are suggesting that he's slightly ahead or a little more ahead than Sheila Dixon, but there's a lot of undecided. So debates are an opportunity for candidates to one more time get in front of voters, in this case on TV and on the radio, to be able to share their perspectives on the issues. And, you know, it's a chance to change the minds of some of those undecideds. And whichever way the undecideds break in this race is probably going to make one or the other of them a winner, or maybe have somebody in third surge a little.
Yeah, and of course, when they faced off the last time, it was very close. Less than 3,000 votes distinguished Brandon Scott from Sheila Dixon. He went on to win the general election. You know, you're the dean of the College of Public Affairs. You've got students at UB who are studying public policy and preparing for jobs in the public sector. There's so much cynicism. There's so much distrust of government in general, and in by some measures, local government in particular. Johns Hopkins did a study last year showing as many as 75% of Baltimoreans didn't trust their local government. It's a snapshot. It's a poll. But when it comes to trust in government at all levels, we really we are in rough shape here in the United States of America.
Well, you know, thank you. And, you know, being a dean that leads a terrific college that's dedicated to public service, I have to say this. What we try to teach our students is that professionalism, the ethics that you bring to the job, choosing public service right now for all the reasons you just said is more important than ever. And that one person can make it a huge difference in government or nonprofit service. We have to have the right persons there. And we have to have a new generation because so many people are retiring. I think that cynicism, and maybe this will sound a little idealistic, but I really believe it. I think the cynicism goes away when people can see that their government is responsive and that the people in it really, really care about changing lives. And that's what we teach here at the University of Baltimore, and it's made my students so successful. I'd also say, you know, the Schaefer Center for Public Policy is a gem. Used to be a hidden gem, but it's not so hidden now. Dr. Ann Cotton and her team have a new Next Gen Leaders in Public Service program. We, as you know, Tom, put out nearly 200 paid internships for students that couldn't afford an unpaid internship to lead in local government and state government in Maryland. So we're really doing our part right now to connect good people into the field.
Yeah, and we had Dr. Cotton on Midday to talk about, along with a couple of her students, to talk about that program at the Schaefer Center for Public Policy. You know, it's interesting, the generational dimension of this race is fascinating. Sheila Dixon, of course, resigned her office in disgrace 13 years ago. There are a number of people who will be voting on Thursday when early voting begins, and then on the 14th on Election Day, who really have not had to consider whether they want to vote for Sheila Dixon because they were too young to vote when she was in office the last time.
Well, you know, absolutely. And then there are a lot of newcomers in our city. People have come and gone since she was mayor. So a lot of people don't know Sheila Dixon. They may not know, you know, the professionalism she's credited with as being a mayor, but also with the legal infractions and ethical portions that led her to leave. So those newcomers are learning about her now and may know Brandon Scott way better than they do her.
And as a 40-year-old, as opposed to Ms. Dixon, who's over 70, do you think Brandon Scott has a sort of inherent leg up with those younger voters, given his age himself?
Well, you know, there's certainly the argument that that younger people appeal more to younger people, and it may be that they understand that generation's issues a little bit more. But, you know, it's definitely not a necessary condition, as we see our two candidates for president right now, right?
Exactly. Dean Roger Hartley, he is the dean of the College of Public Affairs at the University of Baltimore, and again, the Schaefer Center for Public Policy at UB, one of our partners here with WIPR, WJZ, and the Baltimore Banner. Roger, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Great to talk with you. Thank you much, too.
This is WIPR special coverage of a 2024 mayoral candidate debate starting at 12:30. We're talking about 11 minutes from now, something like that. You'll hear from the top four candidates in the race, Mayor Brandon Scott, former Mayor Sheila Dixon, former city prosecutor Tharu Vignaraja, and businessman Bob Wallace. The debate will be moderated by WIPR's own Tom Hall with Denise Koch from WJZ and WIPR alum Emily Sullivan from the Baltimore Banner. I know many people have deja vu when it comes to this year's presidential election, seeing former President Donald Trump and President Joe Biden on the ballot again. But as it relates to this race, voters may be experiencing deja vu as well. All four of these candidates ran for mayor in 2020. As we continue exploring the candidates in this forum, let's turn to former Mayor Sheila Dixon. As we stated earlier, she ran for mayor in 2020, came in second to Brandon Scott in the primary. She also ran in 2016, losing that time in the primary to Catherine Pugh. She was first elected as mayor in 2007, but resigned in 2010, 3 years into her tenure. In an interview Dixon held with Tom Hall in January, He asked how she explained her resignation from mayor in 2010. Here's what she said.
I try to be transparent and open and share with them that bad decisions were made and that one grows from those bad decisions and that you try to live your life, and I've tried to live my life since that time, to be open and honest and to try to give back. Well, I always gave back. That didn't matter what was going on. But to continue to build. And also, everybody, no one's perfect. And here's an opportunity to get a second chance.
Wamboy, do you think Dixon has been sincere in sharing how she's tried to overcome her conviction for embezzlement of donated gift cards? Do voters, you know, even care about this issue? It happened almost 15 years ago.
As far as sincerity, she has apologized more than once. She also wrote an op-ed in The Sun saying that she's, you know, again, that she's sorry. And her core base of supporters are not too concerned about the charge, you know. There are some who say that she shouldn't have been charged in the first place, that this was just government overreach going after Black elected officials. And then there are those who say that she paid her dues.
Okay. Yeah, I know there's a school of thought, at least in previous elections, we'll see about this one, where she had a ceiling of possible voters that she could count on, people who have supported her all along. And then the challenge for her, and we'll see whether she is successful this time around, is to break through that ceiling and get enough votes to win the primary. Finally, let's look at businessman Bob Wallace. He was once a Republican, ran for mayor in 2020 as an independent. He is now in the 2024 Democratic race. Wallace has been passionate about addressing public safety and improving Baltimore City. He wants to apply his business strategies to management of Baltimore. Here's what he said about that on Midday.
I will apply the principles of business that I use to build my businesses and raise my 5 kids, 11 grandkids. I will apply those same principles to running government. The couple of things that have to happen. Number one, We're going to organize the city into villages. Now, why is that important, Tom? Because I learned in business, again, applying business principles. When I started my energy company, we had to segment the market into like categories so that we could map our marketing strategy to meet that particular segment of the market. So when I'm selling solar plants, how I sell it to the government versus the private sector versus to small businesses, it's a different sell. It's the same way in Baltimore City in the neighborhoods. Baltimore has over 200 neighborhoods, Tom. So what we're going to do, we're going to organize the city into villages so that we can—
And these are different than councilmanic districts? These are different than police districts?
Absolutely, because they're going to be tied to the metrics and the characteristics of the people who live in those neighborhoods.
So Wallace wants to group areas into villages. Wamboy, is this innovative or similar to what we already have in the city? And will his message break through to voters today?
You know, what I hear voters say is what they really want the mayor to focus on is disseminating needed resources to each community. What I've heard voters say is that there's already, you know, division in the city, whether you're from West Baltimore or East Baltimore. So they don't want a mayor to be too preoccupied with villages or whatever. They want the mayor to really give residents a bang for their buck, since Baltimore City homeowners pay some of the highest taxes in the state. So they want to see dollars going back to neighborhoods, whether that's paved roads or addressing blight, or like Emily shared with us earlier about education and well-funded schools. So if it takes a mayor organizing things into villages to get that done, what I hear voters say is they just want to see things getting done.
Okay. If you're just joining us, I'm John Lee. That is reporter Wamboy Kamau, who you just heard. We're getting ready for a mayoral debate coming up from the University of Baltimore. It's going to be about 5.5 minutes away at 12:30. Let's talk, Wamboy, about the Key Bridge. That happened right in the middle of this campaign. Mayor Brandon Scott was out in front from the very beginning on that. Politically speaking, I mean, it's a tragic event, of course, but putting it into and framing it into a politics, how has that been beneficial for his campaign?
I would say it's definitely been beneficial for the mayor. You know, during that week, Sheila Dixon was planning to run some attack ads, and she pulled those. And like you've mentioned, just seeing the mayor out in front to tackle this issue, you know, making sure that the grieving families have the help that they need, making sure that first responders also have the help that they need. And then, you know, this has been a multi-agency effort. So also coordinating with the federal government and with the state to, you know, to make sure that the workers at the port can still maintain employment, that people who travel in that area have other ways to get through. So I would say that this has definitely been politically advantageous for Mayor Brandon Scott.
Okay, let's dive a little deeper into the polling that's been going on in this race. Our partner, the Baltimore Banner, conducted a poll with Goucher College last September and then again earlier this month, and that showed a 13-point swing in Mayor Scott's favor. In September, 39% of Democratic voters supported Dixon compared to 27% for Scott. Most recent poll, Scott is at 40%, Dixon at 32%. What do you think might account for that?
A couple of factors. One, like we just talked about, was the tragic collapse of the Key Bridge and just seeing the mayor out in front of this. And then I would also say that one thing that the mayor has really campaigned on or is differentiating himself from Dixon is the ethics, right? That, you know, he's clean. He hasn't had any scandals. And on that, too, is, I guess, where we get into the financing, where he's really been able to raise a lot of money. In the most recent campaign reports, he has $900,000 in his vault, whereas Dixon has $500,000, and Wallace, who's using his own money, has a little under that at $400,000.
Right. So not surprisingly, the incumbent in a race is the best financed and best positioned to run a campaign, has the money to run a campaign. Sure. We should also note that the most recent poll conducted by the Baltimore Sun earlier this month also shows a very tight race. It gives Scott a 38-35% advantage over Dixon. That's closer than what the Banner had. While Vignaraja and Wallace are far behind in the polls, how do you think Vignaraja and Wallace, how they might try to use this debate to help gain some ground?
You know, so far they've really been positioning themselves as the new guys with ideas. And I think that's what they'll try to do this time around as well is, for example, Wallace talking about being, you know, his success in business will help him be a better city manager. And Vignaraja has really been driving the conversation, too, in terms of thinking about redeveloping places like Harbor Place and really just charting this path that they're not bureaucrats. They really want to get into that seat, into the mayor's seat, into that position to do things for the city because they have kind of like an outside lens.
Well, it certainly seems like Vignaraja has hung his hat somewhat on his opposition to Harbor Place. And the other, how does he compare to the other candidates? I know the mayor is very much supportive of it. As far as former Mayor Dixon and Bob Wallace, where did they come down on Harbor Place? I think my understanding is that the former Mayor Dixon is somewhat supportive of the idea of development, and Bob Wallace is opposed to it. So that's certainly an issue in this campaign that has been interesting because there is some differences of opinion on it. We're almost out of time. We can talk a little bit about endorsements in this race. They've kind of taken on a life of their own. Ms. Dixon picked up the endorsement of State's Attorney Ivan Bates, who says the former mayor will take petty street crime more seriously than Brandon Scott. Just yesterday, Dixon picked up the endorsement of Sheriff Sam Cogan. He endorsed Dixon, saying that Mayor Scott has been dysfunctional and difficult to work with. Mayor Scott has his endorsements, too, like from Maryland's two U.S. senators who praised his handling of COVID, pointed out that the homicide rate has dropped, and that the and she pointed out to Scott's leadership following the collapse of the Key Bridge. We're just a few seconds away from going to the debate at the University of Baltimore. By the way, it's going to last for about an hour. It will be replayed tonight at 7 o'clock on WIPR as well as on WJZ. For Juan Boy Kamau, I'm John Lee. Thanks for listening. It's 12:30.
I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vince.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WIPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
Hello, and thank you for joining us. We are coming to you here from the University of Baltimore. WJZ, the Baltimore Banner, WYPR Radio, and the Schaefer Center for Public Policy are hosting this debate to help you make an informed decision when you go to the polls to vote for the next mayor of the city of Baltimore. This is likely the last opportunity for you to hear from the candidates before early voting, which begins on Thursday. I'm Denise Koch from WJZ, and joining me are Tom Hall from WYPR and Emily Sullivan, the City Hall reporter for the Baltimore Banner. The four Democratic candidates with us today were invited based on the latest polling conducted by the Baltimore Banner and Goucher College. They each received at least 2% of the polled support. They are incumbent mayor Brandon Scott, Sheila Dixon, Dhruv Vignaraja, and Bob Wallace. Tonight's debate will involve questions from both the moderators here at the table, the gathered audience here at the University of Baltimore, and some sent in by social media. Each candidate will get 90 seconds to respond to each question. We will be keeping tight control of the time. That's my job. I hope I don't have to interrupt. Joining us in the audience tonight, and we're happy to have them here, we have representatives from community and from nonprofit organizations that have a key stake in the future of our city. Now, each candidate has been asked to prepare a one-minute opening statement and a 90-second closing statement. The order was chosen by tradition, with the incumbent going first, and following that, they are in alphabetical order. We are asking our gathered audience to hold their applause and their vocal response until closing statements, please, so that we can be on time. Now let's begin with our opening statements, and we'll begin with you, Mayor Scott.
Thank you. Baltimore, when I was sworn into office nearly 4 years ago, where I promised a campaign where we would break Baltimore away from the decades of disinvestment in our neighborhoods and people, break us away from the failed leadership scandals of the past, we were at the height of a global pandemic. Homicides had been stuck at over 300 for nearly a decade. Our unemployment was at 9%, and we had been stuck at 16,000 vacant properties for 20 years. But amidst that crisis, I got right to work, producing our comprehensive violence prevention plan. Results: 20% reduction in homicide, 33% reduction this year. Historic numbers. Reopening rec centers, 5 of them in my time, not closing them. Our unemployment hit its lowest level ever at 2.5%, and we've reached our lowest vacancy numbers in more than 2 decades. This is the work that I've done and will continue to do, furthering Baltimore as we move forward together. Thank you.
Sheila Dixon.
Public service is a big part of my life and who I am. I love this city. I love the people of this city. While campaigning through the city, I hear that most people are unhappy with the way things are. They felt that there's no accountability, there's no one listening to them, and the things aren't getting done or getting done correctly. As crime continues to undermine the quality of our city, Baltimore continues to lose residents in droves. The citizens who remained watch our city deteriorate. The people of this city deserve better. They deserve season, they deserve experience, management, and leadership in the mayor's office. I know we can reduce crime. I know we can get our schools in order and improve our schools. We can deliver quality services and address the vacant housing crisis in this city. I know each one of the people we need as partners. And I'm the leader they trust to work with them to get the job done. City Hall needs to stop being divisive. We need to come together and make sure that 10 years from now that we are not talking about these same issues.
Thank you, Ms. Dixon. And Dhruv Vignaraja.
When I was 3 years old, my family crossed an ocean in search of a better life, and Baltimore gave us a chance. It was here they found jobs as teachers. My father, who taught at Edmondson and Douglas at Southern and Western. My mother taught at Poly and Morgan State. When my father retired, he was the oldest teacher teaching in the state of Maryland. He was 80 years old. He doesn't like me sharing that with people, but that's the tradition in which I was raised. It was a tradition of grit and hard work, of faith and public service, and we have tried our best to follow in their legacy. I went to local public schools, went to Yale and Harvard Law School, and then came home to serve as a federal and city prosecutor and as Deputy Attorney General of Maryland. I'm running to be mayor because there is no city in America that has a bigger distance between where we are and where we could be. And the things that they say are not possible, cutting property taxes in half, free college and trade schools for every graduate of Baltimore City Public School, free buses citywide, those things are possible, and I'm running to be mayor to show everyone that it is.
And Bob Wallace, please.
President Smoke and the UB family, thank you all for hosting us today. When I grew up as a child in Cherry Hill, we had numerous challenges. We had economic inequality, we had environmental racism, and we had a government that didn't pay attention to us. But yet we overcame. How did we overcome? Because our parents taught us three things. They taught us education is important because they can't take that from you. They taught us that hard work, showing up, fighting for your rights, and fighting for what is right is important. And thirdly, faith in God. As your mayor, one of my primary jobs is to create an environment where success becomes the norm and not the exception. What I'm going to do to make that happen as your mayor is focus on three things. I'm going to focus on, number one, reinventing government. Number two, reinventing the education system. And number three, rebuilding this economy in the city so that it benefits the neighborhoods. By investing $1 billion of new investment into neighborhoods, creating 50,000 jobs, and removing food deserts once and for all.
Thank you. All right, now for our first question, we're going to go to Tom Hall, and we're going to start down the line. This question will be answered first by the mayor.
Thank you, Denise. Mr. Mayor, in a recent interview, Baltimore State's Attorney Ivan Bates acknowledged that the violence non-fatal shootings and homicide, those rates have gone down precipitously, some 40% over the last 2 years. But he said that 189 of Baltimore's 278 neighborhoods have experienced an uptick in other kinds of crimes, carjackings, car thefts, assaults, robberies. If you're reelected, will the group violence reduction strategy be sufficient not only to keep the murder and the non-fatal shooting rates down, but also address these other kinds of crimes?
So I think, Tom, a couple things that we have to say here. One, most importantly, that when you think about carjackings themselves, carjackings were down 15% last year in Baltimore. They're down again this year across the city of Baltimore. But when folks say that we're not focused on quality of life crimes, BPD, at my direction, enforces those laws each and every day, just so you have the numbers themselves. Last year, they made 529 arrests for robbery, including 131 juveniles. Last year, 786 for stolen auto, including 271 juveniles. They're continuing that work each and every day. They seized 2,902 guns off the streets of Baltimore. Last year alone, we've already seen a 4% increase this year. They, at my direction, are going out there to do all of that. Every time we take down a drug organization through GVRS or other means, that's improving quality of life. We're going to continue to make sure that we have even deeper reductions when it comes to every single category. But we have to acknowledge that people being shot, people being murdered, people being robbed, people being carjacked, are also impacting people's quality of life, and less of that is happening in Baltimore each and every day. We will also continue, Tom, as you and I talk about every month, to make sure that we're working with our partners at the state to improve systems so that my police aren't arresting the same people for the same crime over and over again. And now, with Governor Moore at the helm at the state, we finally have the partner that will work with us to do just that.
Thank you, Mayor. Ms. Dixon.
Crime is up in 221 of our 278 neighborhoods. 2,000 cars stolen this year, the average of 21 cars a day. Baltimore Police Department is 700 officers short. Nationally, people are recruiting officers. We are 20% below the national level with recruiting officers. We have to work in collaboration with our partners. Ivan Bates, Sheriff Kogan supported me because they know that cohesiveness and collectiveness and partnerships is what it's going to take. I know how to reduce crime in this city and how to deal with violent crime and quality of life crime. I've done it before, and we can do it even more now. And I did it during a recession where we had very little money. But we have to do it in a way where we're engaging our communities and neighbors, where we're listening, where we're being responsive to our communities. And where we're short officers, we have to balance what we use. We need the sheriff's department. We need the school police. We need the university polices. We need all of these entities working with us as we do an aggressive recruitment. Arrest is what? Up in the city. You know, I know my opponent said that I arrested my way out of that. No, we did not arrest our way out of it. We didn't do zero tolerance. What we focused on was very targeted. And we've got to work with our schools. Schools, vacant properties, crime and grime go hand in hand.
Thank you. Theroux.
You know, Mayor Scott has a great team. And they give him a piece of paper that has a whole bunch of statistics on it that say that crime is going in the right direction. Well, if crime is going in the right direction, why is the number one issue on voters' minds this election, just like 4 years ago, the public safety concern? Why are people in so many neighborhoods fleeing for the counties if crime is going so well? If people in West and East Baltimore were feeling the numbers that the mayor so quickly quotes, they wouldn't be leaving for Owings Mills and Randallstown and Woodlawn. And the reason they're doing it, because people don't feel safe. And the reason they don't feel safe is because it's just misleading to suggest that crime is going down in Baltimore. Truth is, crime is going down nationwide. Detroit had the lowest murder numbers since 1966. Philadelphia, with a mayor and a state's attorney with very different philosophies, had the lowest murder number in 30 years. These are the roosters taking credit for the dawn. Something that is happening nationwide, they want to pretend is because they did something on their watch. The reality is that the gun violence reduction strategy, it's a great strategy. You should go after violent gangs. You should get and dismantle violent drug organizations. It's what we were doing in 2011 when we got murders below 200. The fact that last year is the year that the mayor celebrates, the year where we had the second highest murder rate in America and the largest, worst mass shooting in Baltimore history, if that is a good year in Baltimore, we had better raise our standards.
And Mr. Wallace.
Just as we have economic inequality in the city, we have inequality as it pertains to public safety. There are some neighborhoods that do well with this and some that don't. So my plan is this. It is to create a village system in the city where we organize the city into villages and we design a public safety program and strategy that is unique to that particular village. This is what we know about crime. Crime will rise to the level to which we tolerate it. That's why, for example, if you go to Roland Park, you don't see open drug markets in Roland Park. You don't see trash on the ground. You don't see guys hanging out on the corner in Roland Park. Why? And I'm not picking on Roland Park, but I'm making a point. Crime will rise to the level in which it is tolerated. Therefore, as mayor, I have to make sure that all the villages, all the neighborhoods have the same kind of opportunity and mentality to not tolerate the crime in their neighborhoods. And that means that we need community policing that is unique to that particular village. I'm interested in empowering community patrol groups. I'm interested in helping the community to take more control of their safety in their neighborhoods. These are the things that we need to do in this city to get this crime under control. Crime is an issue in this city. We do not feel safe. And until we feel safe, we will not be a great city. We will not attract businesses to our community, and our children will not be able to learn.
All right, thank you. The next question, which we'll have Sheila Dixon answer first, is coming from Emily Sullivan.
Ms. Dixon, there's a shortage of affordable housing in our region. In some communities, residents push back when officials propose affordable housing developments, such as apartments. How much say do you think residents should have in dictating what affordable housing gets built around them?
I put out a housing plan, and it talks about basing our development and our housing on the communities. I'm going to create a housing neighborhood authority, which will be a quasi public-private entity
We're going to take the land bank and put that over there so we can streamline the process and be able to move this process quickly so that we can have to leverage lenders to make sure that we can work with communities, because we have all the master plans that are on in planning. But we have to engage the community to be a part of that. Several projects that I've worked on successfully is the Upland project, which is affordable housing. The second project that I work on in Druid Heights, that now is in its third phase, is affordable housing. I know what it takes to bring our partners together and work cohesively in order to address that. But you have to listen first to the community. You've got to work with our partners within the development community, nonprofit and profit, to get them to understand that the way we move Baltimore forward is by we balance what we need to do in our communities. We need to take our TIFs and pallets and go out in the community, which we've done, and I've got example after example under my administration. And I'm going to speed that process even further by working with our city government, our agencies, housing department, and this authority that I'm creating. And I encourage people to go on the website to my campaign and see my extensive plan on housing.
Thank you. Tharu.
You know, we have a profoundly segregated city. And one of the reasons for that is because our housing is segregated. We need to have diverse housing in every community, and the community needs to have a critical say in what that housing looks like. The thing I hear most from the community is their frustration with the lack of progress when it comes to vacant houses. When the mayor, during his opening statement, says we have the lowest number of vacant houses in 20 years, what he's telling you is that 13,000 vacant houses is less than 15,000 vacant houses. What he doesn't tell you is the number of vacant lots has skyrocketed. In the year when we had 15,000 vacant houses, we had 14,000 vacant lots. That number is now 20,000. So if you want to compare apples to apples, the reality is that we have vacant houses and vacant lots more than we've ever had before. What are we going to do about it? We're going to, first of all, do what Washington, D.C. did. Raise taxes on blighted and abandoned property. If you're an out-of-state investor just holding this property for a tax write-off, we're going to force you to do something with it or sell it to someone who will. We're also going to do what St. Petersburg, Florida did. We're going to take property that has unpaid environmental citations into receivership using eminent domain and transfer them to affordable housing organizations and local developers to provide and create affordable housing. And we're going to bring back the Dollar Homes program in a way that works. Under the mayor's approach, in order for you to qualify the Dollar Homes program, you have to have $90,000 in the bank. You know what you do if you have $90,000 in the bank? Not buy a dollar home.
Thank you. And Mr. Wallace.
This is not an either-or situation or both-and. So my approach is this to low-income housing, affordable housing. Every developer who wants to do a project in the city has to, as part of the deal, provide low-income housing to the people of the city. One of the things that we've not done in the past, we've allowed developers to come into the city and to dictate to us how we invest and where we invest and how the people benefit. One of the things that Mayor Wallace would do was make sure that every dollar that is spent in this city, that it has a benefit to the people of the city. For too often, we've allowed developers to come in here and do what they wanted to do, and the neighborhoods just suffer. That has to stop. That can never happen with Mayor Wallace. Because one of the things that's different about me compared to my opponents here is I believe that these vacant houses and vacant land, these are a major asset for our city. They're a major asset that we can use to attract businesses to these neighborhoods. They're a major asset to allow us to create entrepreneurs to stay and thrive in those businesses. And we have to have a mayor who has a business mind, business thinking, to figure out how we use these assets in our city to build this city for everyone and not just for the few. And so it's very, very important that we maintain and recognize the economics of these situations so that the city can benefit and everyone in the city can benefit and not just developers.
And Mayor, thank you.
Thank you. We are not celebrating where we are with vacant housing in the city of Baltimore, but we are acknowledging the great progress that has been made. We were stuck at 16,000 for 20 years, and in just three plus short years, we've removed that down to 13,000. It's why we did exactly what was never done before. We worked with the community and the business community at the same time to develop a plan to deal with vacancies once for all. We already have the commitments from the GBC, from Bill, from our partners at the state to reduce it by investing $3 billion into our neighborhoods over the next 15 years. We are already, I'm glad my opponent mentioned TIFs, I rolled that out in December, that we will be putting that into the city council this summer to finally take tax breaks that have been given downtown and everywhere but uptown in East and West Baltimore for decades into our communities. The projects that were mentioned, Uplands, sat there for 15 years not being completed until I funded it, and that's why it's going to open up in a few months. Park Heights Master Plan, I heard about it when I was in eighth grade. Not a single building was built until I was 30-something years old and the mayor of Baltimore, because we've invested over $100 million into building affordable housing, and we're just scratching the surface. And that's what we're going to continue to do in our next term, is build the housing, because we need it for our people to live in affordable, quality housing.
Thank you. I have a question for you concerning education, and we'll have you, Tharu, answer first if you would. The school board just approved a budget of $1.7 billion approximately. Breaks down, again, approximately to about $20,000 per student. That's the highest in the country, among the highest in the country, for a large school system. A lot of money. But 20% dropout rate, lowest graduation rates in the country. We have tremendous problems. So name just one thing that you would do immediately to try and rectify what is seen as a failing system.
Look, we have to do a lot of things, but I'll start with one thing. The first thing we need to do is to understand where all this money is going. We're going to do the first forensic, independent, outside audit of where $1.5, $1.7 billion is going. We have the third highest per pupil expenditure in the country, and yet the third lowest performance measures in the nation. That's a problem. Now, let me be clear. We do need a lot of resources because our school system is shrinking. Anyone who can afford to move to the county or send their kids to private schools, who didn't get into City, Poly, or BSA, who doesn't live near Hampstead Hill or FSK, they take that option because the other schools are, in their view, not good enough for them. That breaks my heart. We need universal pre-K for every 3- and 4-year-old with guaranteed transit from door to door, because one of the biggest problems with chronic truism is not what's happening in the classroom, it's getting the kids to the classroom. We're going to have guaranteed free college and trade school for every graduate of a Baltimore City public school. So if you go to Dunbar or Douglas and you get into Bowie State or Lincoln Tech or the University of Baltimore or Johns Hopkins, we're going to make sure that finances are not a barrier. And if you ask me, how can you do that? One of the reasons we can do it is we're not right now sending that many kids to college or higher education. 77,000 kids in our public school system, that number shrinks every year. Only 1,000 of them even graduate from high school. Let's at least get the ones that finish that marathon a chance to do something more.
Thank you. Mr. Wallace.
So I sat on the Board of Regents for this state for more than 7 years, and I saw the performance of the students coming from Baltimore City compared to the other 23 jurisdictions, and it is horrible. So to answer your question, Denise, the first thing I would do, if there was one thing, I would change the leadership of our system. I would change the leadership, because from the leadership, that determines the outcome of that organization. As a CEO of companies, I recognize that the buck stops here. And so for me, the CEO, down to my staff, that's what will determine how well we do. Beyond that, we need to look at changing the curriculum in our system that matches the new economy. We need to reinstitute code of conduct for students and code of conduct for parents, because it is a system that all needs to work to make our kids learn. And lastly, we have to find creative ways that we can educate kids who come to school every day traumatized. We have one of the most traumatized systems where our children are traumatized and they come to school. It is almost impossible to learn until we figure out how can we educate children who come to us traumatized. We have enough money and resources to do it. What we need to have is the rethinking and different leadership.
Thank you. Mayor?
Thank you. We know that our young people are our most precious resource. But if we're being truthful, Baltimore, for many, many years, we didn't treat them as such. We're talking about a school system that was underfunded by to the tune of $300 million a year for at least a decade. We're talking about a school system that didn't build a single new school from the time that I was in pre-K through being on the city council. In just my time as mayor, we've opened 12 of them. I'm proud to put more investment into city schools than any mayor in the history of Baltimore, and we're gonna double down on those efforts. Yes, we have to all be reminded what our young people have been through in Baltimore, period, let alone the last few years with a pandemic. Our young people, our kids who are coming from Baltimore City schools, coming into pre-K, are outpacing the state when it comes to readiness. We have to double down on that work. And the most important thing that we would do, Denise, to directly answer your question, is that we have to make sure that our young people are there first. That's why I've invested in their attendance. That's why chronic absenteeism is down and school attendance is up this year. We have to make sure they're there. We're giving them the buildings. We're going to continue to invest in their classrooms and their teachers and make sure that they have all that they need. We have to make sure that they're there. And that's why, as the candidate who is endorsed by our educators, who know best what our young people need in school, I'm proud to be here to support them each and every day.
Thank you. Ms. Dixon.
As a former educator, and going back to when I was on the city council and President Smoke was mayor, and we ended up having a partnership with the state, every mayor has to make an obligation to the school system. That is by law. The blueprint determines what this administration provides to the school. Back up. Our schools are the center of our communities. We know that our children are the future, and we have to work with schools and our families. And I believe in creating more community schools with partners, because in our schools, teachers need to teach, but we need the additional resources, mental health services, and other programs available for that child and that family. I want to extend the school day, because some young people need that additional support and keep the school open longer for parents and guardians to be able to take advantage of computer labs and work within those schools. I also want to work with our communities so that we can provide the kind of support needed to those families. Last but not least, the one thing that is important, if our schools are not safe, which they are not, kids are not coming to school, we have to have a safe environment for every child. And we have to make sure that in doing that, that we are providing them with the extra support that they need.
Thank you. All right, the next question we'll have you answer first, Mr. Wallace. Mm-hmm. And it comes from our reporter, Stefan Dingell. He has a question from someone in the audience.
Yes, Denise, thank you. The topic of homelessness is an issue that plagues Baltimore and all across our country. In fact, it's an issue that is before the Supreme Court. We're here with Lily Frazier. She's a volunteer coordinator with the Baltimore House, which is a nonprofit that provides therapeutic residential treatment supporting vets who are overcoming obstacles to regain self-sufficiency. Lily, welcome. What is your question regarding homelessness and in your role with the Baltimore House for the candidates?
Thank you for the opportunity. Over the years, the city has invested in providing meaningful care for Baltimore's homeless population, which includes the purchasing of 3 downtown hotels. How will you use these hotels to initiate connections between those experiencing homelessness and the many nonprofits positioned to provide services to help those individuals as they transition out of homelessness?
Mr. Wallace.
There, but by the grace of God, go I. I had the opportunity to spend a night in a homeless shelter and meet the men in this case who found themselves in the shelter. And you would be amazed at the stories that I heard. Any of us could fall into a homeless situation at any moment. So what do we do? Well, first of all, the focus has to be to provide housing for those individuals, whether it's through the apartments, the hotels, whether it's through renovating abandoned buildings, whatever it is. The second thing we have to do is to wrap around services for those people. And it's easier to provide wraparound services if they're housed in a safe environment. We have institutions in this city that can provide those wraparound services, Johns Hopkins, Morgan State University, UB, who can provide these wraparound services to help the homeless people. What you will find with the homeless population in this city and across the nation, the biggest issue, there's addiction issues, and there's psychological issues. There are many issues in which people find themselves in that situation. My point to you is, we provide the housing, we provide the wraparound services, but always remember that each of us, only by the grace of God, could be in that same situation. So it needs to be a priority.
Thank you. Mayor?
Thank you. I am pleased to be the person who purchased those hotels to build that permanent supportive housing for our families. And what we will do is deepen that work. The reason why we're doing that is because we know we need to continue the great work that we learned a lot during the pandemic and working with you guys and other organizations about meeting people where they are. We know that we're going to continue. We just announced last month $30 million in our housing accelerator. We're building more units across the city of Baltimore with community CDCs and other groups and nonprofits. But the way that we have to work is we have to continue to evolve. There was a time when folks thought that dealing with our population that is suffering from homelessness was a cookie cutter thing. It's not that. We have to make sure that every single organization that is working with that population is prepared to get where they need to be. That individual, I'll tell you a quick story. Last Christmas, we had the Christmas tree lighting outside of City Hall. I bumped into a mother, her and her five kids at that time. They said they were homeless. We got homeless services involved. We were able to get them temporarily housed. I was walking, knocking doors in West Baltimore last Saturday, knocked on a door. They are now in a permanent house because of the way that we walked them through that process to make sure that we got them from where they were to where they needed to be in stable, affordable housing so that their family could stay together. That work that we purchased those hotels is just the beginning of how we begin to end homelessness in Baltimore. Thank you for your question.
And Ms. Dixon?
First, $10 million went back to HUD for homelessness. We need to make sure that we not lose federal funds that are given to the city. Secondly, we need to work with, I have a plan, a homeless plan, where we talk about housing first and wraparound services. But we also have to have advocates that are out there at night. You can go to the Enoch Pratt Library tonight and see individuals that are living in the bus stop and ask them, has anybody from Homeless Services been to visit you to see what resources you need? I'm gonna have advocates that are out there at night in all of those areas, making sure that we can house them in that hotel that the mayor has paid $50 million for, but make sure that we have the services needed to support them. I worked with a school. There was a family, a mother, and while the child wasn't going to school, and we were working on truancy, they were living in their car. I contacted the city. There were 20 numbers when I called the number to find out how I could help this family. 20 numbers and 20 names. Nobody picked up the phone. I called Eric Costello and said, Eric, I need your help. Eric was able to help me to get this individual into a home so that that child could continue to go to school. We have to have accountability. We have to make sure that we're not saying things and not managing what needs to happen. People that know me and my reputation, they know how passionate that I've been over the years for homelessness and what we need to do to move this and end homelessness in Baltimore.
Thank you. And Theroux.
We know that homelessness stands at the intersection of so many different problems: housing instability, mental health and trauma, addiction. And so when we think about the question that you asked, which is what do we do with the facilities that we purchase, we should be looking at models like the one they have in Boston, where in those places where we're providing an answer to housing instability, we are also co-housing solutions to the other challenges: mental health specialists, addiction specialists, counselors that can help address work deficits and job skills deficits. Those are the kinds of comprehensive things that we need to build. But here's my frustration, because my experience over the past couple of years has been that virtually nothing has gotten better. I was underneath the I-83 overpass when the mayor ordered police in to clear out an encampment of homeless individuals because the farmers market was coming up on that Sunday. It ended with an escalation where an individual poured gasoline around his tent and lit it on fire until the police moved in and interceded. What we need to do is to have relationships with the individuals that face this long before the crisis happens, long before the encampment begins. And the reality is, I feel like I'm in a vortex where we're sitting here on the precipice of these city politicians' first terms. These are all promises about what they're going to do. You had your chance. You had years to address these problems, and they are no better, whether it's park rights or homelessness or housing or education. You've had your chance. You failed. I won't.
Thank you. And Mayor Schmuck, you get 30 seconds. Excuse me, Mayor Scott, you get 30 seconds for rebuttal.
I'm not debating with Kurt Schmoke.
Thank you, Denise. I just want for Baltimore to know some facts. We didn't lose $10 million in HUD funding. It was actually $6 million that we fronted up for the services that were carried out by our partners and agencies. Our city employees were locked out of a portal that they couldn't get into. And I, because of the relationships I had with the HUD housing secretary and others, made a call. And we were able to get back into that system. And we're currently recouping that money. You'll hear a lot of misinformation today. Don't fall for the banana in the pale tail part.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Scott. Now, Emily has the next question. This one, I believe, was sent in to you by social media. And going down the line, the mayor will answer first.
This is about a topic that, as we all know, resonates across Baltimore, city services. Survey after survey shows that folks are just about as concerned with them as they are with public safety. So this question comes from Chris Nicholson. He asks, what will you do to fix potholes, clean litter, and decrease emergency response times? And we'll start with Mayor Scott.
Yeah, thank you for the question. And I think we have to level set this. When I came into office, there was no recycling. We had no GPS in our vehicles. They were using paper maps to find out where everything was. There had been no city stat. That was the reality. We got to work. I said to you when I was sworn in that I would do the right thing, not the popular one. It was the right thing to make sure that we ordered those vehicles. We could not dictate when they got here. They got here in March of 2024. We got to work. We have reinstituted city stat. We have permit stat. We have clean stat. We are seen nationally as a leader in how to use data. We are investing in our city employees that are doing that work that hadn't had raises in so long. That's why the unions are supporting us, because we're doing what wasn't done before. We're uplifting them. No longer will your trash workers have to look on a paper map to find out where they need to go. We finally fought to have the highway user revenue funds restored so that we can build our bridges, repave our roads, fill more of our potholes. That's the leadership that you will continue to get to me. And now, with the investments that we will pull down from the Federal Infrastructure Act, thanks to the president, you will see an alignment that you have not seen in Baltimore. Relationships matter, leaderships matter, and we will continue to push on those efforts each and every day to improve.
Thank you. Ms. Dixon?
It's time for city employees to come back to work. People are not working. If you ride around this city is filthy. We're the dirtiest city in America. It's disgusting, the graffiti. I can go on and on. And I ask myself, as I drive around the city, is anybody in city government seeing what I'm seeing? Is anybody making those calls to make sure that people don't work in silos, even if it's not in their area? I've never, ever seen this city so dirty. Every county in this state, and I even made a recommendation to this administration to, during COVID, to partner with the private sector to help with the recycling, because people were going to be home and you were going to have more trash. And the private sector did step in and work with the city. But I don't get it. I really don't get what I'm hearing today. And it's frustrating, because this is probably one of the areas that I'm most passionate about. But it's also about management and accountability. The mayor is the lead of the city. You set the standards from the bottom up, and you engage everyone involved in that process. Orange Cone was a successful program during a recession where we had contractors and the city resurfacing roads, probably more roads that have been serviced in the last 4 years. But the bottom line is, people need to come back to work in city government. People need to answer their phone. People need to be responsive to their constituents. And yes, we need to make sure that our employees have the kind of skills and have the equipment needed to do the work.
All right, thank you. Saru.
If you ask a sanitation worker why is ours the dirtiest city in America, they will tell you that it began when Sheila Dixon cut twice a week trash pickup to once a week, and it continued through the abysmal dysfunction you see in DPW under our current mayor. If I heard this right, the mayor just said the reason why your potholes haven't been filled, why your trash hasn't been picked up, why there's graffiti on every corner, is because the trucks just arrived in March of 2024. That is a crazy explanation for why services haven't been delivered for the last 3.5 years. Let me tell you what we're gonna do, and we're gonna do it on day one. This is gonna sound like a joke, but if you go to our website, you're gonna see a pothole tracker, a graffiti tracker, a trash tracker. And when you take a photo with your phone of a pothole or a piece of trash or a scribble of graffiti, and you send it in through 311, that will get a geotag, and a pin will appear. And if after 3 days, that pothole is still there, that green pin is going to turn yellow. And after 7 more days, if that pothole is still there, that yellow pin is going to turn red. Now, I don't expect all of you to be spending your nights watching the pothole tracker, but I want my employees thinking you are. I want them worrying that there are too many red pins on that pothole tracker. And then when you actually resolve it, you're going to take a photo of that filled in pothole, that trash picked up, that graffiti off the wall, and you're going to upload it so you can see a before and after. That's how you actually deliver, through accountability and transparency and results, not with excuses about when the trucks just got in.
Thank you. And Mr. Wallace.
I have been, myself and my company, we have been supporting the city with its technology matters since Mayor Smoke was Mayor Smoke. And we have supported every single mayor since then. We were the ones who designed the city stat system that the city is supposed to be using right now. We were the ones who went into city agencies to re-engineer their business processes so they could operate more efficiently. We have that kind of knowledge already. We spent one morning with the DPW workers. Their shift started at 5 a.m. We met them at 4 a.m. And we asked them the question, what will it take to get this city to operate more efficiently? You know what the number one answer was? Leadership. Leadership. So what is Mayor Wallace going to do? I've already got a team of poly engineers lined up, ready to go with DPW. And we're going to reorganize DPW. We're going to look at how we combine back DPW, the transit part of the city, and general services. Why? Because we can gain efficiencies, we think. We can minimize the use of resources and be more focused in how we deliver those resources. As I said to you about crime, crime will rise to the level in which it is tolerated. Filth will rise to the level in which it is tolerated. So as the executive and the CEO, we set the standard. And the men and women I will bring into city government to run these agencies, they will set that standard so that we as a city can be proud of who we are.
All right, thank you. And the next question will begin with Sheila. And Tom, you have this question.
My question is about Harbor Place. There are, under the current plan put forward by MCB Real Estate, a plan for 900 luxury apartments to be built on the waterfront in one of Baltimore's most iconic public gathering places. City Council has passed legislation revising the zoning laws down there so that new structures can be built. What is your vision for not just the Inner Harbor, but for the whole downtown area from Camden Yards, which we've been talking about redeveloping as well, through the harbor and then through Harbor East and further east in Baltimore?
If we don't deal with vacant buildings, if we don't deal with crime, if we don't deal with the quality of city services, if we don't deal with these things cohesively and not in silos, that Inner Harbor will not happen unless we create a master plan that's going to be inclusive of not just the Inner Harbor, because the Camden Yards has a plan and they want to connect. If we don't deal with crime, we're not going to attract tourism to Baltimore. If we don't deal with crime and deal with a filthy, dirty city, we're not going to be able to create the kind of environment. But we have to look beyond just the Inner Harbor. Yes, it needs to be redeveloped. Do we need 900 apartments? No. There needs to be a balance. People have a choice in November at referendum to vote. But we need to create more green space. We need to have a balance of attraction for tourists. But we need to look two blocks beyond that and look at how dead that Baltimore and Redwood Street and Calvert Street is, and incorporate that in an extensive way as we look at the Inner Harbor, not just Harbor Place.
Thank you. Vignaraja.
There's no one that wants to see the revival and renaissance of Harbor Place and downtown more than me. It's where my mom and dad brought me when I was a kid. It's where, when relatives came to town, we took them to showcase Baltimore City. The reality is, however, that we are facing a situation where a developer and a mayor have gotten together and come up with a proposal to tear down historic buildings. Harbor Place was the second festival marketplace in America after Faneuil Hall in Boston. This was the place where everyone came. In the early days, Baltimore City's Inner Harbor was the second most popular tourist destination in the country after Disneyland. That's what I want to bring it back to. That's why I'm the only candidate that has pledged within the first 60 days to issue an executive order that would block the construction of luxury apartments on the promenade. That is a shameful use of our public space. Sheila's right. We need a master plan. It's what Vancouver did with Cole Harbor. It's what Sydney did when they built the Sydney Opera House. We need to come together as a community and decide what grand vision we have for this. A sophomore at the University of Maryland would get a failing grade if his best plan was to tear down historic buildings and replace them with luxury apartments. We should reject it and come up with a real plan.
Thank
for
you, Mr. Wallace.
I get tired of our leadership using our resources to build these shiny buildings around the water, and the people in the neighborhoods don't benefit. How many of you have benefited, who live in Baltimore, from neighborhoods, who have benefited from this investment in these shiny buildings? It just doesn't work. We live in a city where two-thirds of the people in this city struggle every day to make ends meet. We have 25% of our population lives below the poverty level. One out of three don't have a car to get to work. So how dare us continue to use resources to build these shiny buildings for rich developers when our neighborhoods are suffering? That will not happen under Mayor Wallace. So in this situation, to the degree that I am able as mayor, I will pause this project. I will pause it because we cannot continue down this path where our neighborhoods are not benefiting. I'm looking at taking that money instead and investing in the neighborhoods, creating 50,000 jobs for the unemployed and the underemployed, and removing food deserts. That money will be better spent in that situation than building in these new buildings.
Thank you. Mr. Scott?
Thank you. I think that we have to say what's actually happened here. There are zero city taxpayer dollars slated to go towards Harbor Place. For decades, Harbor Place sat there deteriorating on itself, and every mayor immediately before me, not named Mayor Smoke, had the opportunity to do something, and they did nothing. We put this into receivership. It was given to a West Baltimore boy to come up with a plan for how we can build Harbor Place 2.0. And the plan is not just about apartments, because we have to be reminded that downtown is our fastest growing residential neighborhood. People want to live there. It's about creating more park space. It's about changing Pratt Street so that our face to the world is something that people can walk in and not just have to drive on. But we also have to be careful to hear folks who are dogging our downtown and saying that no one wants to be there. $7 billion with a B is going to be invested into downtown between now and 2028. The GBC just released its report card. Half of the investment coming into this region is coming into Baltimore City, most of that in downtown. That's why we have our Downtown Rise plan, working with all of our partners to create what we all want to see, a more vibrant downtown, because the money is already coming and everyone will benefit from it.
Thank you, Mayor. All right, time marches on. Now each candidate will get a minute and 10 seconds for a closing statement. We will go down the line the way we began, beginning with you, Mayor Scott.
Thank you. Baltimore, I won election 4 years ago promising generational change, that we would start to invest in our neighborhoods and our people, and we've had. Historic investments into our schools, historic investments into our neighborhoods, building projects that have been stalled, taking shopping centers like Emerson Village and getting into the hands of the community. I told you that we would deal with reducing violent crime in Baltimore, which you sent me there to do. We did that. No mayor other than Brandon Scott has had a 20% reduction in homicides from 1 year to the next, and now we're beating it at 33%. You told me to lead you through the pandemic, and we did that. We are building a better city government each and every day. Your city is starting to reach some of the potential that we all know we have. Now is not the time for us to turn back. Now is the time for Baltimore to do what we haven't been able to do for almost a generation. Continue with cohesive leadership that has the partnerships from President Biden, from Governor Moore, from Attorney General Anthony Brown, from our congressional senators and our congresspeople to work each and every day with seven of our sitting city council members to build a better Baltimore for everyone. That's what I'm asking you to do. Allow me to finish the job that we started that is producing results every day.
Thank you. And Ms. Dixon.
I hear a lot of ayes from Mayor Scott. Addressing these issues take partnership. I know the partnerships we need to turn the city around. Senator Barbara Mikulski, trust me. Sheriff Sam Cogan, trust me. State's Attorney Ivan Bates. Delegate Sandy Rosenberg, the longshoreman, Mayor Jack Young, Councilman Eric Costello. I'm only saying these names because the governor has already committed to Baltimore City to work with whoever's mayor. The federal partners will work with who's ever mayor. And when you are a manager and a leader of the city, you know how to work at all levels because we have to work in partnership. Everyone on this stage loves this city, but only one of us has what it takes to turn this city around. Progress cannot happen with a mayor who antagonizes his partners when we need partnership to move forward. I will always work with our partners to deliver results for the people of this city. Progress can't happen when you have a mayor who doesn't listen to the people and who sells our infrastructure to PG&E and did not listen to the people. He failed us when we lost money because of the failures of deadlines with HUD and the census and ARPA. I will bring accountability. We need a city hall that ensures that we work together cohesively. I appreciate this opportunity and I need your vote.
Thank you. Tharu Vignaraja.
I love this city from the bottom of my heart. My mom and dad brought us here to build a new life, and we have lived the American dream. It has been the joy of a career to run for office to become the next mayor. But I'm running for mayor because things are not going well. It takes me no pride, gives me no pride, no joy to share with you that we're the only city in America that over the past 25 years has lost 25% of its population. When the mayor says he's the only mayor that saw a 20% reduction in homicides last year, that's true except for every other mayor in America last year. The reality is that things are not going well. And if you think things are going well for the past 4 years, then I ask one question of our prior politicians. Why is everyone leaving? If things are going so well with schools and crime and potholes and housing, why is everyone leaving? The reality is that things are not going well for the people that desperately want to love this city. And I'm pledging to do things that have never been done before. And if you think we can't do it, if I'm wrong, that we can't cut property taxes, create affordable housing, deliver free college and trade school, vote me out. But first, you have to vote me in.
All right, thank you. Wait, 1 second. Baltimore, Mr. Wallace.
Baltimore, we are in a crisis situation, but never let a crisis go wasted. Crisis in itself means that there's this coexistence of these two realities, right? There's danger and there's opportunity. What is the danger for us as a city? The danger for us is to continue to elect failed leadership and failed policies that never worked and don't work and expect a different result. If you want to change a system, you have to change something. If you want to change the system, you have to change something. So what's the opportunity? The opportunity is that we change the leadership, the failed policies, and we pivot. We pivot as a city into the future, into a better direction. And I believe that Bob Wallace is the best candidate to take you into that future. Now, yes, I do not have the name recognition that these folks have. So what I want you to do after this debate is over, you go Google Robert L. Wallace, and visit me at wallaceforbaltimore.com to learn more about who I am. But more importantly, when you're in that quiet moment and you are with your ballot making a decision, make sure you make the right decision for the city. Because if you do not, the children, your children, and your children's children will suffer.
Thank you.
I believe you make the right decision.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. And thank all four candidates. We appreciate you here for this very lively debate. Now you may applause and cheer. And we thank you for joining us as we consider the most important problems facing Baltimore and the solutions envisioned by these four candidates. A reminder, early voting begins on Thursday, and our democracy only works if we all vote. I'm Denise Koch. Goodbye.
All right, you've been listening to a mayoral debate brought to you this afternoon by WYPR and our partners, WJZ, the Baltimore Banner, and the University of Baltimore. I'm John Lee. I'm joined in the studio by my colleague, Wamboy Kamau. The candidates were asked about a number of things: crime, education, affordable housing, homelessness, as well as fixing potholes, that's a perennial, and developing the Inner Harbor. Wamboy, you've been following this race between the incumbent, Mayor Brandon Scott, former Mayor Sheila Dixon, former prosecutor Tharu Vignaraja, and businessman Bob Wallace. You know, did you hear anything that was off the candidates' talking points this afternoon, something you hadn't heard before?
The one thing that I really haven't heard before is all of four of them delving into homelessness and what they would do to provide better services for that population.
Yeah, they did seem to talk about that in depth. Matter of fact, at one point, Mayor Scott offered a rebuttal when addressing problems with the city's Department of Homeless Services.
We didn't lose $10 million in HOPE funding. It was actually $6 million that we fronted up for the services that were carried out by our partners and agencies. Our city employees were locked out of a portal that they couldn't get into. And I, because of the relationships I had with the HUD housing, a secretary and others, made a call. And we were able to get back into that system. And we're currently recouping that money. A lot of misinformation today. Don't fall for the banana in the tailpipe.
Thank you.
And I just appreciated the reference to banana in a tailpipe. Hadn't heard that one before. Thank you, Mayor. Mayor Scott talked up his administration's accomplishments after entering office during the strain of the COVID-19 pandemic.
But amidst that crisis, I got right to work, producing our comprehensive violence prevention plan. Results, 20% reduction in homicide, 33% reduction this year. Historic numbers. Reopening rec centers, five of them in my time, not closing them. Our unemployment hit its lowest level ever at 2.5%, and we've reached our lowest vacancy numbers in more than two decades. This is the work that I've done and will continue to do, furthering Baltimore as we move forward together.
Sheila Dixon contrasted the positivity of the mayor's opening statement, saying there are plenty of problems unaddressed in Baltimore City.
As crime continues to undermine the quality of our city, Baltimore continues to lose residents in droves. The citizens who remained watch our city deteriorate. The people of this city deserve better. They deserve season, they deserve experience, management, and leadership in the mayor's office. I know we can reduce crime. I know we can get our schools in order and improve our schools. We can deliver quality services and address the vacant housing crisis in this city.
You know, certainly, Wamboy, listening to this debate, it did at times feel like three against one, which is what happens when you're the incumbent and you have three people running against you. How do you think the mayor did in as far as defending his record as mayor over the last 4 years?
I think he, you know, did a great job of reminding people just where things were before he came in and what took him so long in a way to really deliver on his promises. For example, in talking about potholes, that, you know, it wasn't just about dispatching crews to go and fill these potholes, but it was also just about ordering the right kind of equipment, the right kind of vehicles, because when he stepped in, as he said, the city was just so behind having paper maps instead of GPS. You know, those kind of things. So for him, he's saying that he's made monumental progress, which is and kind of better late than never.
Yeah, and certainly we were wondering whether Mr. Vignaraja and Mr. Wallace were going to be able to do or say anything today to help their campaigns. Every poll shows they are trailing far behind both the mayor and Sheila Dixon. Did you hear anything today that might be some sort of a breakthrough for either candidate?
You know, we'll have to wait to see how people vote on that. But, you know, Tharu Vignaraja is never afraid of a fight. And he was very pointed in his statements. At one point, he told the mayor that, you know, you've had your chance. You failed. I won't. And that's also something that maybe he was implying to Sheila Dixon, who has already served as mayor.
Right, right. Well, as a reminder, Denise Koch said this a couple of minutes ago, but it's important, so I'm going to say it too. Voting is already underway. People are dropping off ballots at the drop boxes. Matter of fact, I think I'm dropping mine off on the way home. Early voting begins on Thursday, and the final day of voting in the primary is going to be May the 14th. Hey, thank you very much for listening to our special coverage of today's mayoral debate. Now, if you missed some of it or would like to experience it again, it will be replayed tonight at 7 on WIPR. WJZ is airing it tonight at 7 as well. Up next is Fresh Air. On today's show, best-selling fantasy writer Leigh Bardugo is best known for her young adult Shadow and Bones series. Her new adult novel, The Familiar, set in 16th century Spain, is about a young woman who can make miracles happen, but she must hide her identity as a converted Jew from the Inquisition. That's coming up next. We're going to be joining it in progress, Fresh Air, at 1:30. For my colleague Wamboy Kamau and our partners at WJZ, the Baltimore Banner, and the University of Baltimore, I'm John Leigh. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.